There is something in the playful imitation of instruments, which chase one another around in seemingly infinite loops, that just screams Baroque music. The aching simplicity of slow sections, where voices move toward and away from harmonious intervals, building up towering structures of sound. I'm Nikki Sweat, and welcome to Audio Notes. On this session, I'll be talking about Baroque Splendor, the first concert program of the Menlo season, which will take place on July 15th. That was the concerto for four violins by George Philip Telemann, thought to have been written sometime before 1721. On the program, it'll serve as a fiddle-filled overture for the concertos, arias, and sonatas to come, a perfect introduction to the qualities that make Baroque music quite irresistible. The concert includes a rare mix of 17th and early 18th century pieces that feature the trumpet. First, the instrument gets to shine as a soloist in a sonata written in 1690 by Italian composer Giuseppe Torelli. We can hear the instrument grow more and more extroverted over the course of this sonata. At first, the trumpet only plays when deliberately invited by the strings. In the second movement, the soloist starts calling the shots, and the others even struggle to catch up in places. By the finale, the high brass instrument is performing an acrobatic role. This short sonata warms up our ears to how this instrument gets used generally in Baroque fare. It's the kind of model for trumpet writing that composers like George Friedrich Handel and Johann Sebastian Bach are playing against when they composed major works that highlight that instrument. The Baroque Splendor Concert includes three arias for soprano, trumpet, and various ensembles. The first, a meditative number that Handel wrote for Queen Anne's birthday in 1713, uses the trumpet in an astonishingly voice-like fashion. The second, from Bach's cantata Exalt God in Every Land, sees the trumpet cueing the soprano in with celebratory fanfares that the singer attempts to imitate in turn. And the text of the final number in the set, Handel's Let Bright the Seraphim from the 1740s oratorio Samson, explicitly calls for trumpets to blow, and blow they certainly do in this aria. I spoke with the soprano Erika Bykoff about singing with the trumpet and how the instrument interacts with the voice in these three arias.
I think we normally associate trumpets with royalty, important announcements, historically inviting people to celebrate. And so it's really nice to just have this like celebratory kickoff. As a soprano and as a slightly lighter soprano, I don't normally get to sing very commanding, authoritative roles. So I feel like interacting with the trumpet kind of gives that color and that opportunity to do so here. I also think that the colors of the instruments are quite different. Trumpets are very brassy, can be a little bit blaring, very exciting. Not to say that the voice isn't all of those things, but I do hope to kind of add a little bit more warmth to the sound of a trumpet. Often taught to sing as if we're string instruments, but actually recently I've noticed myself leaning more towards instruments like oboes. And I think that there is something similar in the trumpet and oboe in that it's not a naturally vibrating instrument, and there's a lot of beauty in the straight tone and the piercing quality of it. But not piercing in a grating way, but just in a very deep and grounded sense. I think it's really nice to imagine a very different instrument to a violin or a cello, which we're always told is like the most singing instruments of the orchestra. In the first piece, Eternal Source of Light Divine, it's actually kind of the soprano who sets it all off. I find the trumpet is a very inviting, welcoming, announcing instrument, so the roles are a little bit reversed. Also, it's a much warmer sound, actually, from both instruments. It's really just the two instruments intertwining and weaving around each other. It's very harmonious, very peaceful, but still quite royal in a sense and majestic. The other two, while yes, of course, they are different, also different composers, Bach and Handel, they do have this element of joy and excitement that I do normally associate with the trumpet, which I think is really wonderful. In the first one, Jauchzet Gott in allen Landen by Bach, here, the trumpet does kind of take on the normal role where it announces everything that's going to happen or invites us to celebrate together. I do think the distinction of character or role is quite clear here. The trumpet provides an earthy foundation for then the soprano to spring off into these really fun and exciting coloratura runs, where I think is kind of hinting at heaven and the joy in heaven. The next aria as well. The text is quite joyous. Let the bright seraphim in burning row their loud uplifted angel trumpets blow. Let the cherubic host in tuneful choirs touch their immortal harps with golden wires. The minor section serves as a reminder that joy and pain, they're relative, and so in order to have one, you must have the other.
The concert also features selections from Handel's 1707 secular cantata Il Delirio Amoroso, or The Delirium of Love. The arias heard here involve substantial solos for string players, making them sound like true chamber music between a singer and an instrumentalist. Erica's told me the story of this cantata and how the first aria she will sing fits in with this narrative.
It's the story of Tiresias and Clarice, which are the Arcadian shepherds. Clarice mourns the death of Tiresias, who on earth has multiple times rejected her love, and so he is sent to hell and punished for his rejection of her love. But she, out of love for him, she goes to the underworld, or to hell, Hades, however you want to see it, to save him. And still, even in hell, he continues to reject her, but she, again, out of the goodness of her heart, pulls him out and brings him into the Elysian fields. And I guess together they end up in the afterworld. In the first aria that I sing, Per te lasciai la luce, she's already in hell with him and telling him that, you know, I've left the daylight for you. why do you continue to reject me? Why are you uncertain? Where are all these, not feelings of hatred, but just no affirmation of love coming from? There's quite a close connection with the cello and the voice in this aria. It could be the uncertainty of Tiresias and his inability to say something back. I don't think it's that he doesn't love her. I think it could just be a fear of not being able to say something back. The cello is quite wandering here. It never really creates a stability. And so to me, it seems to represent more of Tiresias, not unlove or hatred, but really just maybe confusion or uncertainty.
The second aria from Il Delirio Amoroso on this program actually occurs a bit earlier in Handel's original. It's a bright number where Clarice is considering whether she thinks Tiresias has gone to heaven or hell. Erica explained how Handel achieves character exposition in this aria, and what the role of the violin solos might be in all of this.
Clarice musing on whether Tiresias is in heaven or happy in heaven or whether he's in hell. And I think she presumes, or rather, it's that like in her delirium, she sent him to hell to be punished for his rejection of her. The violin is serving as a vehicle for her thoughts flying either to heaven or to hell, but essentially searching for him. Violin does play on its own, and I think that's also kind of representative of her solo journey in all of this, which then shows how brave she is to be able to make these decisions on her own, to make this journey on her own, and that even though she is on her own, there's a musical confidence in it. It shows the strength of the instrument on its own, and I think similar of her strength.
The Baroque Splendor Concert will also include two concertos by Antonio Vivaldi. Early on in the program, we'll hear his A minor concerto for bassoon and strings, RV-497. The bassoonist Peter Kolke told me about Vivaldi's concerto writing in general, and he introduced me to the piece that he'll be playing on this concert.
Vivaldi's primary employer for many years was the Ospedale della Pietà in Venice, which was essentially an orphanage slash music school slash convent for young girls. It had a history of really excellent music education, and Vivaldi was not a composer there, but he was rather the violin teacher, although one would assume that he had some very excellent pupils whom he wrote for. So much of his music is for solo instrument with an orchestral ensemble behind it. I think over 400 violin concertos, which makes sense because he was a violinist, but there are 37 bassoon concertos, more than any other instrument besides violin. Now, why the bassoon? That is one of the eternal questions of bassoonists today. We'd like to think that there was some young girl in Venice who was an amazing bassoon player, and Vivaldi was completely inspired by her playing and wrote her these amazing concertos. The truth is a little, perhaps not as interesting. There's no record of the Ospedale actually ever owning a bassoon. And of course, these young girls wouldn't have had their own instruments. They were orphans. So we're not quite sure who would have played these. We know of two dedicatees who were, they were sort of wealthy patrons, but for the others, we just don't know. For the time being, I'm just going to envision a 14-year-old girl woodshedding these things in some sort of dark room with a candle. What Vivaldi does incredibly well is he takes the two parts of the bassoon, the sort of baseline continuo part that we know so well from Baroque music, and combines it with melody writing, sometimes within the same measure. You'll hear a lot of large leaps up and down. The bassoon will, on one note, be a bass instrument, and on the next note, it'll be the melody instrument, and then it'll jump back down to the bass instrument. So you're constantly leaping all over the place. This concerto is RV 497 in A minor. It's one of four A minor concertos Vivaldi wrote. And this one, it happens to be, just by coincidence, the first one I ever learned. What is really interesting about this piece is the contrast between extreme rhythmic propulsion and moments of very calm stasis. So at the opening of this piece, you have nine bars of just crazy rhythmic energy. It just is so dramatic. And then it's followed by this pause, this silence, which has a fermata on it, so it can last forever. And then the next thing you hear are the upper strings playing a lyrical melody. And for the bass to drop out there at the beginning is really shocking. You've had all this momentum, and then the bottom drops out of it, and you're just floating on whatever is left of the sound. It is a special moment to have this rest come so early in the piece, and it's operatic. Vivaldi wrote a lot of operas. We don't hear them today. They're not considered his finest works, although they contain a lot of amazing music. So we have this drama that's being presented to us as if it were on the operatic stage. The word I kept coming back to when I was thinking about this is arresting. It's a very arresting moment. Your heart stops, your breath stops, like what's going to happen next? And then what does happen next is not what you would expect. The second movement opens with just a really beautiful, simple motive, which is passed through the strings from the top first violin on down through the bass instruments. When the bassoon does finally come in, it picks up that motive, but the upper voices go away. The main part of the movement is just bassoon and bass line, which allows the bassoonist a whole lot of flexibility. It's the closest thing we would have to a sort of Baroque aria in Vivaldi's concertos, where we just spin out these long lines supported by only the bass line. So there's plenty of time to breathe. It's a very humane approach to writing melodic material. The first time I played it, I was a freshman in college, and I'll never forget playing it. It just like opened my ears to what Baroque music could be. Only when the bassoon is done with its soliloquy do the upper voices re-enter. So it's sort of bookended by this beautiful motive, and the bassoon has its sad song in between. That middle movement it's long, it's beautiful, but you need to have a moment before that last movement, because the last movement is all fireworks. It is lots of notes. In fact, there's a passage, the last five measures are just incredibly difficult. They just fly by, and you know, you wonder if you've done it right, but it's over in the blink of an eye, and it's almost there's not enough time to perceive what's come out of your instrument, because you just have to go so fast. What is also really, I think, fascinating about this movement is the second violin part. I know this is perhaps a nerdy thing to say, but the second violin part just has these half notes throughout. It's like it's on another plane. It's just got these sustained things. And it comes from like Renaissance mass writing, where one voice would have this slow moving part against some busyness in all the other voices. And one is reminded that Vivaldi indeed was a priest, and he had a lot of experience with sacred music, even though we think of him often as a secular composer. He was a priest, and he knew that style just as well as his own. I think of Venice during Vivaldi's lifetime, what it would have been like. Having been there myself in the 21st century, it's very easy to get lost. You got to watch out for those canals. I just picture Vivaldi being able to find his way in the dark through some of these things. He just knows exactly the right path, like he would have to in his home city, to make all these things work and come together.
We see a completely different side to Vivaldi in the concerto that will appear on the latter half of the program. It's a sparkling piece for flute in D major. Many of Vivaldi's concertos have earned nicknames. This one has come to be known as Il Gardellino, or the Goldfinch, after the bright flute calls of the opening movement. The bird comes back down to the earth for an intimate dance in the second movement, a duet between soloist and continuo. The movement is based on the dotted Sicilian rhythm, a figure with a distinct Baroque lilt. The finale of this flute concerto isn't quite as boisterous and wild as that of the A minor bassoon concerto. But what it lacks in devilishness, it makes up for with a virtuosic brilliance that only the flute can really achieve. The joyous D major finale sends us back up into the sky with our friend the goldfinch, flying this way and that in generally good spirits. It's sobering, then, to come to the end of the concert and hear variations on one of the oldest known musical themes. It's La Follia, meaning madness or follies, a melancholy harmonic scheme dating back to 15th century Spain, which was taken up by an astonishing number of different Baroque composers. The progression happens once without resolving. Thank you. And then it happens again, leading up to a clear cadence in the home key. The famed Italian violinist Arcangelo Corelli was one of that pack of composers who decided to write variation sets on La Follia. He used it as the basis for a sprawling set that closed out his Opus 5 collection of violin sonatas. His student, Francesco Gemignani, made a name for himself in the 1720s by publishing ensemble arrangements of Corelli's sonatas. His orchestration adds enormously to the varied perspectives on this subject already contained in the source material written by his teacher. He calls for both soloists and tutti renditions of the material, and he often has these groupings alternate between the two halves of the theme. He gives his violinists some absolutely astonishing virtuosic responsibilities. And he assigns many of the same passages to the cellist as well. There's plenty of time for pondering the details of the pattern in more lyrical versions of the tune that occur later on. Only at the very end of this set of variations do we actually hear a departure from that harmonic scheme, a modulation partway through the pattern to the relative major key. It quickly reverts back to D minor, but it's a clear sign that the piece is coming to an end, that the potentials of this sequence have been spent for the time being, and that all that's left to do is come to a close with a furious Baroque flourish. Audio Notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Erica Bykoff and Peter Kolke for speaking with me on this session. Audio excerpts are courtesy of the following artists and organizations: Telemann's Concerto in D Major for four violins, TWV 40202, was played by Francesco Folana, Danby Paul Wong, and Sean Lee. Torelli's Sonata in D Major for Trumpet, Strings, and Continuo was played by Stephen Burns on trumpet, Ida Kavafian and Theodore Arm on violin, Kim Kashkashian on viola, Fred Sherry on cello, Alvin Brehm on bass, and Charles Wadsworth on harpsichord. Vivaldi's Concerto in A Minor for bassoon, strings, and continuo, RV 497, was performed by Mark Goldberg as the bassoon soloist, with Aaron Keefe and Francesco Falana on violin, Richard O'Neill on viola, F.A. Baltacigil on cello, Xavier Foley on double bass, and Kenneth Weiss on harpsichord. Handel's Eternal Source of Light Divine from the Ode for the Birthday of Queen Anne, J.S. Bach's first aria from his Cantata No. 51, Handel's Let Bright the Seraphim from Samson for soprano, bassoon, trumpet, strings, and continuo, and the two arias from Handel's Cantata Il Delirio Amoroso were all sung by Joel Harvey. Brandon Ridenour was the trumpeter, and the ensemble of musicians included Francesco Falana, Kristen Lee, and Aaron Keefe on violin, Richard O'Neill on viola, Mark Goldberg on bassoon, F.A. Baltacigil on cello, Xavier Foley on double bass, Kenneth Weiss on harpsichord, and also Soo-Yun Kim on flute. Vivaldi's Concerto in D Major for flute, strings, and continuo, RV 428, can be heard on the Music at Menlo Live album, Musical Odyssey, Disc 1. It was performed by Carol Wincense on flute, Eric Broud and Annie Kavafian on violin, David Kim on viola, David Finkel on cello, Charles Chandler on bass, and Kenneth Cooper on harpsichord. And Gemignani's Concerto Grosso No. 12 in D Minor, based on La Follia, was from a Chamber Music Society performance given by Paul Wong, Annie Kavafian, Yura Lee, Daniel McDonough, Chad Hoops, Danby Pierre Lapointe, Mihai Merica, Anthony Manzo, and Jian Sun. Audio Notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.